Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we get to utilize a listener's question to discuss a topic many of you have asked us about. Hugel culture, which is a form of permaculture that does permanent plantings on large bodies of wood. We know you're really going to be interested in that. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens. So let's jump right into your fascinating facts and comments and tips and tricks, etc. At 1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. I'm in northeastern Oklahoma, about 50 miles north of Tulsa.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Carol in Oklahoma?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, you had a caller, a man in Philadelphia, who rescued all the houseplants that his neighbors would throw away. And I do the same thing after holidays. The grocery stores throw away just beautiful plants, and I have the post-Valentine's Day plethora of long-stemmed roses, about 11 dozen. And little hybrid roses in pots. But my main question is, what am I going to do with about 11 or 12 blooming orchid plants about which I know nothing at all?
Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding? Have a flower show in your house. And these are all Phalaenopsis orchids, right?
Yes.
These are the most commonly sold orchid. They're really easy to raise. They're sold very inexpensively. But they flower repeatedly. They tend to have sometimes 20, 30 buds on a single stem, and the flowers will open up in sequence so that when you get 7 or 8 of them open at once, it really does look like butterflies, or the person who gave it the common name of moth orchid thought they looked exactly like tropical moths they had seen in the rainforest. So they're really easy to identify, and they're very easy to care for. First thing you want to do is get rid of any decorative foil or anything around the pot that's going to hold moisture in there.
Okay.
Hopefully the medium in which their roots are sitting is a coarse bark. In the wild, most orchids are epiphytes. They're actually creatures of the rainforest. And what happens is they have these big, crazy white aerial roots. And they use those to attach themselves to a tree, kind of wrap around branches and stuff. But they're not parasites. They don't take nutrients from the tree. They're literally just hanging on. So one of the biggest, easiest ways to kill an epiphyte orchid like your moth orchids is to actually plant it in soil or to let the bark mulch that's underneath there start to decompose. So make sure that it's just loose bark in there. The only thing in that pot that the bark is doing is keeping the orchid upright. It really doesn't provide any other function. Because these plants are native to the rainforest, they exist in dappled shade. Very rarely do they ever get to the top of the canopy. They're getting a little bit of light that comes through the trees. So you don't need bright light for orchids. You want to keep them away from windows. Believe it or not, the best place for an orchid is ambient room light. Just enough light for you to be able to read by. And watering is very important. These orchids would love for you to mist them every day. Because again, think about the rainforest. It's always humid. But because they're epiphytes, their roots are never in water. So mist them every morning that you feel good about it. And then once a week or so, take them to the sink, keep them in their pots, put some water in the sink, and then put these pots of orchids sitting in the water, in the room temperature water in the sink, so it comes in through the drainage holes and saturates the bark a little bit. Let them sit there for an hour or two, and then put them in the drain board, then put them back on display for like another week. And if you know, get a schedule, do this. This will be like a Sunday thing, a Saturday thing, but if you have unopened buds, you could have orchids blooming from them to July. And then I want you to go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org, look under Garden Answers A to Z for orchids, and it'll give you a couple of tips on trying to get them to rebloom after that. But you do this, and you should enjoy your plant salvage for many months to come, even if they don't rebloom.
Thank you, Mike. You are wonderful. I'm going to give away most of these plants, and the public institutions are always happy to get rescued plants. You might point that out to your friends in Philadelphia from a couple weeks ago.
Oh, I know so many dumpster divers, Carol.
Good for you.
All right, you take care. Good luck.
Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. How you doing?
I am doing just fine today. Bill, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Where are you?
I'm in West Philly, but my wife and I are looking to buy a house a little further out of town. And we're on our way in the car to take a look at the house for a second time. And there's been this nagging question I had about the yard.
Okay, and this is the house you're looking at for sale.
We're no longer looking at it because someone else snatched it up in the meantime. But we have this question because we've seen it in other places.
Okay.
Where the backyard will have some grass in it, but there's also a fair amount of moss, which mm-hmm. I've never seen before. I've seen moss growing on trees. I've seen moss growing on rocks, growing on all sorts of things except on bare ground. And I was looking around to try to come up with an explanation as to why, you know, there'd be so much moss here. And there are trees around. You know, there's a nice big tree in the backyard. But it didn't seem overly shady. And it also didn't seem overly moist, the soil did. So I'm curious to know if you've encountered this
in
the region.
Moss is a huge issue, both pro and con. A lot of people who have moss, what they feel interfering with their lawn, they want to get rid of it. And then other people who are sick of taking care of their lawn, they've seen these beautiful expanses of moss and they want to know how to cultivate it. So there is a big movement in moss lawns. It typically needs three things. It needs moisture, it needs shade, and most of all, it needs an acid soil. Now, the soils in our part of the country tend to be acidic. It's not always the case, but the basic rule of thumb is the more rainfall an area gets, the more naturally acidic the soils are going to be, whereby the areas of the country that are dry, their soils tend to be more alkaline. And moss thrives in an acidic environment. A lot of times, if, as you say, there is not a lot of excessive moisture and it doesn't seem like there's that much shade, a simple dressing of lime or wood ash to raise the pH of the soil would knock back the moss and then give any grasses that were there a chance to grow. But people also tend to not be realistic about lawns. Lawns, even the most shade-tolerant grass, needs a good 4 hours of full sun a day.
Okay.
So a lot of people think that they should be able to grow grass, and there just isn't enough sunlight to maintain it. A lot of times when you see big trees like that, they're also competing for nutrients with the lawn, whereby the moss is right on the surface of the soil, and it's not a heavy feeder. And again, in areas of high rainfall, the moss is going to be kept relatively moist. When that tree is leafed out in the summertime, it's going to provide a lot of shade. And people can either fight it. There are ways to, you can get rid of it. And then if there's not enough sun for a lawn, you can introduce a shade-loving ground cover. But a lot of people realize, well, the moss is green all year long. It never needs to be fed. Never needs to be cut, and it looks great from the house. And a lot of people will actually just lean into the moss and cultivate it and make sure they keep that nice green carpet out there. There's even mosses that can take a little bit of foot traffic. There's companies that sell moss sod, like sod for lawns.
So what do people do if they want to have, you know, a little better mud retention? in their moss? Is it strictly getting the right strain of moss, or are there also landscaping techniques that go on?
Yeah. So instead of attacking it with wood ash or lime, you would encourage it by dusting it with peat moss, maybe a little bit of sulfur every once in a while to keep the pH nice and low. And if there's an area where there's just a high water table and nothing seems to grow there and the moss doesn't like it there, that's where you do some hardscaping. That's where you put a nice little walking lane through to keep your shoes from getting muddy.
Got it. All right.
All right, man.
That's very helpful, Mike. I appreciate it. It's interesting to learn about the cultivation of moss.
Yes.
I didn't have that growing up.
You may learn a lot about it in the future.
All right.
All right, Bill.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear on Saturday and Sunday, March 12th and 13th, at the Fredericksburg Spring Home Show at the Expo Center in Fredericksburg, Virginia. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Hoogle Culture, more of your fabulous phone calls, and me. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a question of the week that I know is going to intrigue all of yous. We get questions about permaculture and lately Hoogle culture a lot. So we're going to answer a listener's question and discuss the possibility of actually growing permanent plantings on dead trees. You won't want to miss it. And you won't if you keep listening through lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Nathan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just ducky today, Nathan. Thank you for asking. How is Nathan and where is he?
I'm good, and I'm in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Very good. What can we do for Nathan in Mass?
Well, my question is regarding starting seedling apple trees. Last year, my wife and I were living in the Morristown, New Jersey area, and we noticed in that area there seemed to be a plethora of older apple trees because of the orchard history of the area, mostly fruit farms for New York City. And it developed a little bit of interest in me to start cultivating some of my own seedlings, knowing that there's a percentage of chance that, of course, they won't produce fruit or may produce undesirable fruit, but I decided that it was something that I wanted to bring back to Massachusetts when we moved back there. So I started stratifying a bunch of seeds, and I succeeded in bringing up a bunch of seedlings. And now I have them in my basement in Massachusetts because our house is rather cool. It stays a consistent like 75 or so degrees in our basement. And I have grow lights down there, compact fluorescents. And my question is, they're getting bushy.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to be growing height-wise. And
okay.
I'm wondering, I have them about 3 feet above the plants right now because that seemed to disperse the light well. But now the plants are almost 6 months old, and they're only like a foot high. And
they are so confused, Nathan.
That's what I'm thinking.
First, let's drop back to starting apples from seed. I can virtually guarantee you that the seed of an apple will not grow that same apple. Could be a good one, could be a bad one. It won't be sterile. You'll get apples from the tree. This was the philosophy of Johnny Appleseed, who started these apple orchards all over the country, because during that period of time, apples were grown less for fresh eating than they were for making hard cider. Alcohol was hard to come by. But if you had a grove of trees producing, who cared what kind of apples, you could make cider and then ferment it. And the cider was universally tasty and very high alcohol. A lot of people also kept pigs. And apples are a tremendous food for pigs. And when the tree was done, the apple wood would be used to smoke meats and stuff. I mean, a tremendously useful tree, whether you're trying to grow a specific type of apple or not. What concerns me is that you've exposed them to summertime in the wintertime when they should have been dormant. And what time of year did you move, though?
We had them in a window. So I was aware that they wouldn't grow true to the varieties, but I thought that was kind of the excitement of growing them, is that they might, you know, develop some new variety or something. But we started them for the most part in August, September, and we moved back to Massachusetts in late November, early December.
Okay, so if you had a time
had them on a windowsill before,
yeah,
if you had doing well.
Of course, they were doing well, but you're not thinking that these are plants that need to go through the cycles of the seasons. I mean, apples have what's called a chilling requirement, for instance. They need hundreds of hours below 40 degrees. It's going to take us a while to get them through their cycle. You might wind up even having to start again. Now, if we had a time machine, which would be the most useful thing on my show, when you got to Massachusetts, I would have said, take all your little apple saplings, find a nice piece of land that drains well, put them in their pots in the ground up to the soil line, and then simply surround them with caging to protect them against deer, or if they were really puny and you were worried about them, some burlap wrapped on stakes around them as well. But they're like thinking it's summertime right now. And the only thing I can, it's going to be really interesting to see if these suckers flower. This is going to be a great experiment. But I want you to start hardening them off. I want you to lower their temperature. Now, they're in full leaf, right?
Yeah, they're in full leaf. They look very healthy in their bushy. Didn't seem to be growing height-wise.
No. The issue is, this should be July or August as opposed to what it is. And they're going to be very confused at flowering time. So it's going to be, might even be a little tough to keep them alive. What I'm going to suggest, because there's no book about this, is you immediately lower the temperature. Make sure those lights are off at least 12 hours a day. And when we get to even the end of March, which I know is still cold there, I want you to slowly start moving them out, hardening them off, taking them out for longer periods every day for about a week. And then I want you to do what's called heeling them in, just putting the pots in the ground, buried up to the soil line, and protect them, because I presume you have deer in the area. Just, you know, wrap like a cage around them. And then we just have to see what happens at flowering time. you know, typically they would be putting on their growth and then flowering. But if they just continue to grow leaves and don't flower this year, but they're healthy, then continue this process, move them into bigger containers, heal them in the next winter as well until they get to be about 2 or 3 or 4 feet high, and then plant them in their final locations.
Okay, sounds good. It was very much an experiment, and I'll do the things that you said, and we'll see what happens.
If you do it again, keep them in season, outside in the summertime, but also outside in the wintertime with their roots below the soil line.
Okay.
All right,
good
luck.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Good luck, Nath.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Michelle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Michelle.
Good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you. Where are you?
I'm calling from Haines, Alaska, in southeast Alaska, north of Juneau.
Right, up there at the very top of the Inside Passage, all those beautiful waterways and mountains. What a great part of the country. What can we do for Michelle in Haines, Alaska?
Well, I have a greenhouse rehab project going on,
mm-hmm.
and I've got a small greenhouse. It's 8x8, and it's built on the edge of the beach here where my garden is, and so it's kind of perched between some rocks, and it's a plywood platform, basically. And what I'm wanting to do is put basically some raised grow beds in the greenhouse. I've mostly been doing container gardening in there. I kind of want to switch to more of a permaculture kind of a system and add some heat sinks and that kind of thing in there. And what I'm wondering about is I've looked all over online. I've looked through your answers A to Z, and I haven't seen anything about grow boxes as far as how to line them or protect the bottom if they're built out of wood like that.
Okay, so
I don't want the floor to rot out, and I know it's going to need some kind of drainage and that kind of thing.
Okay, so you're in a part of Alaska where you get a summer where it doesn't get dark for like 90 days, right?
Well, no, we're not that far north, but we do get some long days, I think 18 hours or something like
and,
that.
And those long days are great for growing potatoes, lettuces, cabbages, carrots, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But you do need to capture some heat and some extra light to grow things like tomatoes and peppers, right?
Exactly, and that's what the greenhouse is for.
Now, what I did when I had a greenhouse like that is we built a big bench down the middle out of rot-resistant wood, and then we put containers on top of the bench. That's the smart money. I mean, you're talking about really cold, wet soil down there on the ground. So if I were you, I might do some sort of planking in the bottom of the greenhouse, because you're going to have to do something to give it a structure. It's you know, some people would pour concrete, but some people would just have some rot-resistant 2x4s around, you know, to bolt the greenhouse down to. But I would put planking on the floor, and I hear what you're saying about permaculture and raised beds, but I think you're going to get more bang for your buck if you do mostly containers. And if you want to do something like grow boxes, I would do these ones that are becoming popular these days that are up on stilts, like even on a foot-high platform. Get them away from that cold ground, and also get them up to the height where it's comfortable for you to play around with them. You don't want to be out there kneeling down in this place. Even just a picnic table in there instead of a conventional bench. You can cover the top of the picnic table. You can grow all your lettuces and potatoes and herbs and everything like that. And then in the couple of open areas you have, you can just have big containers straight to the ground with a couple of tomato plants in them. I think keeping it modular is going to work much better for you than trying to set up a little system of raised beds, because you're going to run out of places to rotate your tomatoes. I think you'll have more fun because really what you need, you and I know this, you need the actual greenhouse. You need the structure. You need the insulation.
Yeah.
You need the light capture. Other than that, I would make it a modular system inside with containers of all sizes. And that way, if something goes south, you just dump it out and replace it with something else.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's what we have been doing. But I've been wondering about making more of a heat sink to hold the warmth that we capture during the day so that it's, you know, in the soil and releasing back at night.
The way you would do a heat sink is you would have like a stone wall in there, something that would heat up in direct sun during the day and then radiate it out at night. That would be your passive heat source. If you can get some big stones, you can even have those outside the greenhouse to keep the area outside of it warm.
Well, we've got plenty of those on the beach, I tell you.
Well, there you go. You got your own materials.
Yeah.
All right, Michelle. Good luck.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Good talking to you.
1-888-346-9499. Lisa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. So I'm like over the moon. I live in Manayunk in a row home. I have a nice deck. I've got a basement with your whole little light arrangement thing, you know, that you've always recommended. And I found out yesterday I'm being gifted a 5-gallon rooted plumeria, which is a tropical plant. And I'm nervous as I can be, and I want to know what to buy and what I should do when it arrives next week.
When it arrives next week, how is it arriving?
I think Federal Express, and I think it's coming from Florida. I was sent an email that said something to the effect of, based on the weather patterns or something, we think shipping next Monday is ideal.
Okay.
Don't tell me there's another blizzard coming.
Well, I don't know the exact weather prediction right now off the top of my head, but this is a very tropical plant, hardy only down to zone 10, which means there's very few places it can even grow outdoors in the United States. And you know, it seems funny they'd be shipping it at this time of year. Wouldn't you wait till like April or something?
Well, actually, that's why I'm calling you. I mean, this is a gift from a friend who knows I'm passionate about them. And I guess she figured I could keep it under the grow lights until it can go out on the deck. But if you say no, I'll try to shut it down.
Well, here's the deal with these plants. These are beautiful tropical plants. They love being outside in the summertime. And I'll tell you one of the most amazing things about them as we proceed. But they are tropical plants that go through what's called a true dormancy. So whereby my pepper plants and bird of paradise and all the other tropical plants I drag inside for the winter, they continue to bloom and grow over winter. A lot of people who have plumeria the first year freak out because it does great outside all summer. They bring it indoors. They do their best to give it light and heat and water, and it drops all its leaves, and the leaves turn yellow.
Okay.
And they think, oh, my God, I've killed it. But that's actually just what they do. So one thing, when it arrives, if it's going to arrive in wintertime, I would expect it to be in a dormant phase. I'm not sure it'd be really good for the plant to arrive here in like February or March and, you know, be in full bloom. Because if that was the case, then, yeah, you'd have to get it down to your little shop of horrors, get those bright lights on it. Lie to the thing. Try to convince it. No, it's June. It's June. It's really June outside. And then when it really is June outside, you take it out. And I mean that really specifically. This should be like the last plant to go outside. So the first thing you need to do is contact this plant company and ask them, which they're going to respect you because it's a very intelligent question. Are you sending me a plant that's in flower or dormant?
Okay.
And if it's being sent dormant, then all it has to do is not freeze on the way. But that it still seems risky to me. I mean, if it sits in a truck in the wrong place on its way to you for a couple of hours, it could freeze. But they'll hold your hand or whatever. But those are the two ways it's going to come to you. It's going to come to you dormant, or it's going to come to you in full flower. If it comes to you in full flower, do everything you can to keep it flowering. Move it outside in June. And then when you bring it in September, you'll put it in a cool, dark spot, and you're not going to worry when the leaves drop off and everything. It's kind of like an amaryllis bulb. It'll come right back for you the following summertime.
Yeah, well, I'm excited. Okay, so call these people, find out if it's dormant. If it is dormant, let them go ahead and ship it or still...
Yeah, ship it, and then it goes in the basement. And if it doesn't revive in the spring, they got to send you a new one.
Okay. Okay. I'm so excited. I've always wanted one.
All right. Well, now you got one coming. Good luck, Lise.
Thanks for answering my question, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you and good luck.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show will open next weekend and run through Sunday, March 13th, celebrating the 100th anniversary of our fabulous national park system. But don't go looking for all the details at theflowershow.com just yet, because we'll be right back with Hoogle Culture and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Hoogling Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to a question of the week that we get a lot of questions about. The permaculture technique known as Hoogle culture that takes old wood and turns it into fertile fields. It's something you're not going to want to miss. It's a fascinating topic, and it's coming up with a couple more of your fabulous phone calls right after this.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Julie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Julie. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am just ducky today. And where is Julie great?
I am great in Montgomery County, Maryland.
Very good. Very good. Near my Washington, D.C. stomping grounds, occasional stomping grounds.
That's right.
All right. What can we do for Julie?
Well, Mike, I hope you remember that this past fall you spoke in favor of a bill that I was working on with the county council, and it became a law in October called the Healthy Lawns Act. So Montgomery County became the first county in the country to restrict the use of cosmetic lawn pesticides on public and private property.
Congratulations to you, and congratulations to me. I remember taping that testimony. Now, you know, this is amazing. I don't think people around the country realize what a hotbed of lawn care improvement the Washington, D.C. area is. In addition to this new law, which I understand rolls into effect over a period of years, there are already severe restrictions on the type of fertilizer you can put on lawns in all of Maryland and all of Virginia, the times of year you can fertilize your lawn, and a restriction on phosphorus, all designed to help protect the Chesapeake Bay from the terrible pollution problems it's been having. And the fact that these laws were passed in both states continues to amaze me. It's just great. And as you and I know, people's lawns look better because they're not being overfed or foolishly fed.
That's right. They'll be much healthier. But you're right. The law, it's going to take place in two phases. So this summer, it goes into effect on county property. And then in January 2018, it's going to apply to private lawns.
And this is a restriction specifically, remind me now.
So it's a restriction on use. So from the use of the cosmetic lawn pesticides. So there are exemptions, of course, for agriculture, golf courses, gardens, and athletic playing fields.
Oh, that's terrible.
That one is terrible, especially, I know, because the law is justified in protecting health. But this is the argument was that it was strictly about lawns. But they did include playgrounds and children's facilities.
Great.
And mulched areas.
And this is very much a restriction on chemical herbicides.
Yes. So things like Roundup, 2,4-D, you know, the whole list of.
I, of course, love this law. I embrace this law. I want to take this law to the prom with me.
The law passed with a 6-3 vote on the council, and it actually had the support of some lawn care companies. So hopefully once the law takes effect, people will see what a great benefit it is.
And I'm sure the landscapers are still allowed to use things like corn gluten meal and the new iron-based herbicides and herbicidal soaps, right?
Yeah, and there will be a whole list of safe products that are EPA-registered pesticides approved by the National Organic Standards Boards and pesticides with ingredients that don't require EPA registration. So they'll still have things that can be used. And remember, this is just for lawns. And we're talking about usage, so it's cosmetic usage. So if people have a grub issue, if there's an invasive issue, the law has exemptions for that. So,
it's
a pretty fair law.
And this is Montgomery County, Maryland.
Yes,
okay.
It is. And we're a population of 1 million residents, so we really this is pretty historic. But now we have to just make sure that the law is implemented and people are made aware of it.
Right. So if people want to learn more about your organization and what you still need, where can they go?
They can go to safegrowmontgomery.org, and they can like us on Facebook, where we always post your great information and videos and radio broadcasts. So that's safegrowmontgomery.org.
SafeGrowMontgomery.org.
Montgomery.org,
which of course stands for organic.
All
right. Thank you, Julie. This is great. I don't know how much I've been able to talk about the new lawn care laws in Maryland and Virginia on the show, and I just embrace that opportunity. The thought of improving the Chesapeake Bay just makes me smile big.
Thank you so much, Mike. We love your show.
All right. Thank you, Julie.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jerry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing good, Jer. How are you, sir?
Just fine.
And where is Jerry Fine?
Cambridge City, Indiana.
Cambridge City, so it's like a mixture of Boston and Indiana, huh?
Something like that.
All right, what can we do for Jerry in Indiana?
I've been thinking about this for a long time. Would it be possible to take a tree or any kind of plant and put it in a plastic pot or some kind of pot and dwarf it? Would that bring down the size of the plant?
Well, typically, when you want to grow a tree that's normally big, but you want to keep it small, what you do is either if you have the skills or you can hire somebody who has the skills, you can have most plants spliced onto a dwarfing rootstock. You'd still get the right plant above ground, but then you would have a rootstock in the soil that would keep the top part of the plant much smaller than the standard size. You know, this is done with fruit trees all the time, with roses, with lots of other plants. The best way to keep a plant small that is normally big is to start out with a dwarfing rootstock. Then you don't have to go to any trouble. Now, what you're talking about in theory sounds good, but what's going to happen is the same thing that happens when people plant trees that are either still in containers or still wrapped up inside a burlap bag in a steel cage. There has been nothing done to tell these roots not to try to grow super big. So they wrap around themselves inside this constricted area.
And girdle.
And girdle, exactly. And the tree has a short life. So inside a plastic pot buried in the ground, one of two things would happen. Either the roots would girdle, or if you put in a plant that had a very aggressive root system, my money would be it busts through the pot in year two. There is a technique with plants that are only going to be grown in containers that growing them in a container will naturally keep them small. I've seen this over and over again with trees that were not grafted to a dwarfing rootstock but were grown in containers, either in the right climate or brought inside for the winter, that stayed moderately small. But I can tell you there is a technique for the brave that would have this work perfectly. And essentially, it's almost the same principle as an outdoor bonsai, in that you can always control pretty much the top growth of any plant by aggressive pruning in the winter or the spring. But what bonsai growers do to keep the entire plant small is they will also uncover the root system every year or two, and they will do what's called root pruning, actually severing some of the roots. Now, as you can imagine, this is not for the timid. I mean, you know, there's not a lot of room for error here, but I know for a fact that the first couple of times people do this, they, quote, fail miserably. And those miserable failures are actually them going to school, because 10 years later, they're doing this without even thinking of what they're doing. They're doing it while they're reading a book or something. They've just gotten good at it. But I'm afraid that if you simply put a full-size tree in the ground with its roots inside an invulnerable container, that it's just going to girdle and have a very short life.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
All right, Jar?
All right, sounds good, Mike. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for an intriguing question, sir.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. If a tree falls in your backyard, can you plant something on it? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, read us this week's intriguing question.
I'd be happy to. Joanne in Delaware County, PA writes, "A big tree fell over in our backyard this winter. Luckily, it didn't hit anything important. The main part of the tree has been cleared away. Now there is a giant root ball covered in dirt that pulled out of the ground. Instead of disposing of it, I think it would be cool to add more dirt to make a big mound and grow plants and flowers on it. What plants would grow well in a decomposing stump? It would be nice to have flowers and plants that are beneficial to bees and birds. It's in a sunny location."
Well, you know, it's funny because she is absolutely describing hugel culture, the permaculture technique of piling up wood, covering it with soil, and using it as a giant raised bed that becomes more fertile every year as the wood breaks down slowly.
Wait a minute. You always warn people not to till wood chips into their gardens or nothing will grow there.
And that's still always going to be the case. Mixing fresh wood with soil creates an environment where the wood is going to steal all the nitrogen it can to facilitate its decay, starving the plants in that bed for years, but eventually yielding increased fertility. This is a different technique, and it's hugely popular. We get emails asking for more information about it every week.
So this is a permaculture technique? You've talked about your friendship in the 1990s with Paul Mollison, an Australian who popularized this style of long-term planting.
Yes, permaculture as in, quote, permanent agriculture. Now, the specific idea with hugel culture is to collect fallen wood that's ideally already beginning to rot. Once wood starts to decompose, it's not stealing nitrogen anymore. Then you cover the wood with soil and plant perennials on it. The theory is that they'll grow better every year, never need food or water, and after 20 years or so, the wood will have completely decayed into super-rich soil. A guy named Paul Wheaton out in Montana is perhaps the best-known proponent of this technique. He's been dubbed the Duke of Permaculture, and he is immensely popular on the web.
Yes, but so are you, Mr. Half a Million YouTube TED Talk views, and you're the king of compost. Are you really buying into someone else's technique?
Yeah, I'd like to think that I can still grow and accept new ideas. There's a lot of old wood around out there waiting to be used, and this technique has stood the test of time. I talked to my friend Sebastian, a biodynamic devotee from Germany, about this, and he said, quote, "Anything can be grown on these mounds. As the carbonaceous mass in the hole starts to rot, the fertility begins to grow." He says they provide excellent drainage and early warming of the soil. In some ways, he says it's the ultimate raised bed garden.
Wow, you're getting very accepting in your old age.
It was either that or being an even crankier old man. Now, I had a great talk with hugel culture Paul, and he hates wood chips more than I do. And he shuns chemicals as much or more than me. And gardeners always want to try new things. You know, there's no chemicals at all involved in this technique, so let's go out and have some fun with it.
But you're talking about rotting wood, and her stump is still super fresh.
Well, it's not ideal. In traditional hugel culture, you dig a little pit and fill it with a mix of fresh logs and rotting wood from the forest, teeming with all kind of wonderful fungi, microorganisms, and other living things. So I would suggest we begin with a year of accelerated rot, either using the wood to attract pollinators, grow mushrooms, or both.
Right. You could drill little holes in the wood to attract carpenter bees and deeper holes for mason bees to colonize. And seeding mushroom spores into the stump would really accelerate the decomposition, especially if she found the right mushrooms for her specific type of tree.
You know, I really like the mushroom idea. There's a good possibility she could grow some very useful mushrooms, either edible, medicinal, or both. But even ones that are just crazy ornamental would be really cool. Now, growing mushrooms outdoors using what's called plug spawn inserted into a tree stump is going to take longer than with an indoor kit. But the shrooms are going to produce for several years longer in an outdoor system. If she's interested in trying to produce things like shiitake or oyster mushrooms, this is definitely at least the way to start out.
Then you'd make one of these permaculture mounds after a few years.
Well, when I talked with Paul the other day, he said he'd make it tomorrow, but absolutely now or later. Cut the wood into smaller pieces if you have the equipment. Add some older branches. Push it all towards the hole that the fallen tree left behind. Cover it with a couple inches of soil. And then plant a bird, butterfly, and pollinator garden of perennials on top. Maybe even a fruit tree after it all settles down for a few years. And if you don't have access to chainsaws and backhoes, Paul says to just cover the stump with whatever dirt you have and be patient. Nature just loves to fill in blank slates. Well, that was a nice introduction to the world of permanent agriculture, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with links to Paul Wheaton's great hugelkulture sites, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. And that's it. We're out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Oh, and as a personal kindness, would you please include your location? Thank you so much. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where we really don't care about your location. And where you will find the answers to all those questions you were going to email us about. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. And before you send me a lot of emails, I know that hugelkultur is not exactly the correct German way to pronounce the word, but that's how Paul pronounces it, and he gave me permission to. So there. Rich Banowitz keeps our website well-cultured. We also welcome back Sarah the She-Devil Kazar to our internet team. Alexis Landis permanently produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Al Banks' Hoogles are editing. Unfortunately, always temporary are production assistants, currently the eminent Eileen Kelly, because soon they have to go out and find real jobs. I'm Mike McGrath. Many people would say I'm still looking for my first real job, but I am permanently planted in the organic tradition, and so I will hoogle on back to see you again next week. What flies by night, eats your plants, and is now found from north to south? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll examine the antics of an Asiatic beetle on spring break, plus your fabulous phone calls.